Hello again, this is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about Reconstruction. In fact, I've entitled this lecture, North Over South. And what I'm going to look at in Reconstruction, I mean, really, Reconstruction is one of the most important periods in American history. And that's because what you have going on here is not just Reconstruction of the South. That's often the way it's portrayed. The South is going to be reconstructed, and the South is under the federal heel. But really, Reconstruction is a time period when every element, every aspect of American society is going to change. And what I mean by that is not just the South is going to be recreated. It's going to be the North that's recreated. And that process begins during the war. It's going to be the West that's recreated. And oftentimes we don't look at it this way, but, you know, for example, the Indian Wars were part of Reconstruction. In fact, it's part of a, in many ways, a foreign policy objective that comes out of Reconstruction. So when we talk about Reconstruction, we're looking at it at wholesale changes across the board. Again, not just the South, but the North, the West, and the South. So all three areas of the United States are going to undergo generally political changes, economic changes, and social changes. This is a dramatic shift in American history. It's when the Union of the Founders dies and we have a new Union. And I'm going to talk, I mean, the Republicans are very open about this and what they were doing, but we often don't portray it that way. In fact, when you look at the deification of Abraham Lincoln, he's often portrayed as a guy who saved the Union. In the last presentation, I talked about that. Lincoln didn't save the Union at all. He forged a new Union, as the Republicans said. If he wanted to save the Union, he could have. He only had seven states out of the Union in 1861 when he took office, but he didn't really care about that. He cared about having a new Union with Republican dominance, and that's the key. It's also important to note that when we talk about Reconstruction, of course, the time frame that you're generally given with Reconstruction is about 1862 or 63 to 1877. Well, those years are bogus. In fact, those years were put on us because historians like to have general, starting points and stopping points. But really, Reconstruction takes place for a much longer period of time. In fact, you could say that Reconstruction takes place all the way up and through the 1970s, perhaps even to today. So when you start talking about things like the New South, when you start talking about things like the Gilded Age, when you start looking at things like the Civil Rights Movement, for example. I mean, all this stuff really is an outreach of Reconstruction. And Reconstruction is also going to affect the Constitution, as we'll see in this presentation, dramatically affect the Constitution. So the way we look at the United States changes. It's the process by which the United States is recreated. So rather than Reconstruction, this is North over South, the recreation of the Union. This is a recreation without really making any changes to the Constitution, and generally by dragging one section into it, the South. And of course, the efforts in the West are also going to be discussed. So this is a Northern dominated, a Northern vision of the Union will dominate. Now, as I mentioned before, this is a changing Union from Republic to Empire. We go from a Federal Republic under the Constitution, at least when you had the without the direct election of senators. But you still have the states have a dramatic impact on this document. Well, after the war between the states, of course, that's not going to be the case. So we go from a federal republic to an empire. When you look at economic restructuring, this is the victory of the Hamiltonian state capitalist system. If you want to talk about where we are today, and you look at all the things that are going on in the economy now and how bad it is, and how everyone looks at the government for a central planning. You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to save the economy, et cetera, et cetera? Well, all that goes back to the Hamiltonians. I mean, the Jeffersonians warned us about this all the way back, in the early 1800s. They said, if we get a fusion of government and finance, this is what we're going to get. Well, we have it. It's state capitalism. And it's the antithesis of the free market. Even during the Gilded Age, when you start looking at the quote-unquote robber barons or industrial statesmen or whatever you want to call them, when you look at that period of time, all of those guys were making their money, with the exception of a handful, maybe even less than a handful, because the federal government was involved in one way or another in promoting industry, commerce, and finance. So without that machine, without that fusion of these two big, powerful things, we don't have the Gilded Age. Perhaps you have industrial growth in the United States. You would have, because the Americans are enterprising people. but you may not have had this situation where you have tremendous corruption in the process. And that's that corruption that Hamilton talked about all the way back in the late 1700s when they were putting this thing together. Now, of course, I don't think anyone foresaw at that time the situation we have today, but there was tremendous, tremendous corruption back then, and of course, tremendous corruption in this period, all of that fueled by influence from the government, and you can't get around it. So, again, economic restructuring is one of the most important aspects of this particular period we can talk about. There's political and governmental consolidation. You're going to get the centralization of power in Washington, D.C., and the loss of states' rights. I mean, that's a really important trend. We talked today about nullification, about states' rights. Well, after 1865, that stuff in so many ways dies because, theoretically, the sword decided it. Well, I mean, the sword can't decide anything. The theoretical issue was never settled. The legal issue was never settled. People will point to, of course, the very famous Texas v. White Supreme Court decision where they said secession was illegal. But even in that, the Supreme Court is never going to rule that secession is legal. It just won't do that. It won't undermine itself. So the Supreme Court had to rule in that particular case that secession was illegal, or all 4 years of it is not going to be, is going to be worthless. I mean, why even have that to begin with? If secession is legal, then what were we doing? That's an illegal war then. So the Supreme Court will always be complicit in this particular situation of centralization. It always has been, going back to the Marshall Court. So what you're going to get here, again, is all this power going to D.C., away from the states, and the states become mere provinces. And that's actually by design. The Republicans talk about this. They talk about centralization, and that's what they really wanted. So if you look at the monstrosity today that we have in D.C., again, you have to point back to the Reconstruction period, or the Recreation period is more accurate, and look at how that centralization began. You're also going to get a very aggressive foreign policy out of this. And of course, when you get to the imperialist stage of American history in the late 19th century, you start seeing America go beyond the original founder's design of what we should do here and start expanding into other places around the world. You know, for example, Asia, Latin America. But all the seeds of that are sown here in Reconstruction, because America in this particular period starts thinking of itself as a country that should spread liberty and democracy to other peoples. We did it in the South. We're able to go down to the South, conquer the South, bring them our form of democracy. We're going to shove it down their throat, and if you don't like it, we'll kill you. And since we can do that there, well, then let's go to the Indian tribes in the West. And if we can do that there, well, what's to say we can't do this in other parts of the world? We're going to spread liberty and democracy to other parts of the world. This was not about, for example, a Western expansion, a natural expansion that the founders talked about into North America. This is acquiring colonies for the sake of acquiring colonies. This is going out and being very aggressive and telling people they're going to be like us or we're going to kill you over it. I mean, that's a different type of foreign policy. And the seeds of that are sown in this particular period as well. So Reconstruction, again, is affecting all levels of society. And again, when you start talking about progressivism in the 20th century, and I know a lot of people point back to the progressive era as why we are where we are today, but in reality, the progressive America began in this Reconstruction period. So this is an important time period, and perhaps in so many ways, outside of the founding, the most important time period in American history, because it brings us where we are today. I mean, everything after it, you can just put it within the context of Reconstruction. All of 20th century American history should be placed within the context of Reconstruction, because that's what's happening here. Everything is being reconstructed or recreated. And I'm not going to get into a New South discussion in this particular presentation, but if you look at the South today, just to kind of give you a little talk about that, if you look at the South today and you look at the minimal impact agriculture has in the South, for example, well, that's by design. The North was foisting its Hamiltonian system all over the country, and of course the South is going to be part of that. When the stock report has become more important than the cotton report in the South, things have dramatically changed. And it's that commercialization, that industrialization, again, it's going to affect every element of society. And if the South had won the war, for example, or gained its independence, would that have been the case? Certainly, I think you would have seen some industrialization in the South, but I think it would have taken a little different tack than it did if with the North winning just looking at the Confederate Constitution, for example, it would have had to. There's that element in it. And of course, again, I mentioned the Gilded Age and the West. So we're going to talk about all these things. Now, North over South. Once the South was out of the Union, the North could operate the government without any interference. And if you go back through American history in the 19th century, what you're looking at is tremendous interference in this Hamiltonian system from the South for the most part. So the South had always opposed these federally funded internal improvements. The South had been the obstacle to a central banking system. The South had been an obstacle to tariffs, for example. All of these things that the North wants to promote industry, commerce, finance, all of these things are going to be blocked by the South. So once the South is gone, if you really want to see what the North wanted and their designs on the Union, you got to go back to that 1861, 1862 period, principally 1862, and the amount of legislation that the Republican-controlled Congress will start passing. What they were doing is setting up that if they won this war, there was no way the South was ever going to be a block to this kind of stuff again. And really what you have today in modern American politics, there is no block to this stuff. It's just about who's going to get the spoils. Which party is going to get in control of those spoils. And I don't care if you're talking about heavy defense spending or heavy social welfare spending. Who's going to control that corruption? That's all it's about. The South was about keeping that corruption at bay. Now we just have a situation where there is no obstacle to corruption anymore. It's gone. The only obstacle that there could be would be the states, but the states actually have to grow enough backbone to do it. And again, because of Reconstruction, that's going to be a very difficult proposition. You're also going to get the loss of the agrarian order in the United States, particularly in the South. From this point forward, you're going to start seeing a loss of agrarianism. And even, you know, through the 19th century and early 20th century, there were still a lot of farmers out there. But the ultimate design was to get rid of that, whether it was in the South, the North, the West. And so farming is eventually going to take a back seat. I mean, if you want to be funny today, you pick on farmers. I mean, farmers can't defend themselves. You know, comedians all the time pick on rednecks, farmers, whatever the case may be, because they're seen as hayseeds, you know, backwards people, rural people. They're just not sophisticated. They're not chic, whatever the case may be. And you can get a lot of laughs by picking on these people. But the fact is, they were the backbone of the United States for a very long period of time. And nowadays, they're just not seen as that important. And again, the Northern ideology is going to dominate. The South is unable to oppose anything the North can do from this point forward. The Democrats in the North are unable to stop the Republicans. And so you really don't have a situation where Hamiltonianism is going to have a check anymore. And that's the real, travesty of Reconstruction. There's no check to this federal ascendancy. There's no check to this Union heel. There's no check to any of this stuff. And you can look at the Congress or the presidency, but they're going to become complicit in all this. There are very few periods in American history in the 20th century, the late 19th and 20th century, where you really have a strong obstacle to this centralization, where you really have a strong obstacle to this Hamiltonian system. It just isn't going to happen very much. That, again, is a travesty of Reconstruction. Now, what was the Republican economic agenda? Well, you're going to get a number of things happening during the war. For example, through the National Banking Act, you're going to get the creation of a national bank again. Now, it's a modified national bank. It's not Hamilton's monster bank, but it is a national banking system, and it's going to work within that independent treasury structure that was formed during the Polk administration. Of course, we are going to get the Federal Reserve in the 20th century, and Dr. Woods is going to go into that. But this national banking system comes out of the war, and we never go back to a period where we don't have a central bank. So the 1860s, again, we get a central bank, and it never goes away. We had had two central banks before this. Each time they had expired, once in 1811, once in 1836, because there was always opposition to the central banking system and what it did to individuals, people who were not tied into this fusion of government and commerce and finance. So that's really what's happening here with the central bank. You're going to start getting higher and higher tariffs, particularly when the Republicans are in power. In fact, in 1890, you're going to get the highest tariff in American history. But what you're going to start seeing in the 1860s is a general uptick in the protective tariff. Again, this is essentially the government subsidizing industry. They're making it to where people have to buy American products when the competition could be better and cheaper. So Americans now are forced into purchasing something they don't want because of price. And again, that's going to help Northern industrialists. For example, we're going to talk about Thaddeus Stevens a little later on. Thaddeus Stevens made a tremendous amount of money during this war in iron foundries. This guy got huge government contracts, and they're rolling rail in the north during the war. And guess whose iron they're buying? Thaddeus Stevens. So here you have a fusion of government and industry, government and commerce, government and finance, and people are going to make tremendous amounts of money on this stuff. And it's not just that, it's subsidies. Your railroad empire that's built in this period is going to be heavily subsidized. Land grants. We'll talk about homestead legislation and how that's going to change the West. But it's also going to change wealth in the United States, because a lot of these very wealthy railroad companies are going to get some of the best land by working the system. And then, of course, they can sell that land or build the railroads through it or whatever the case may be. And they're going to make tremendous amounts of money on this stuff. So land grants are going to affect how much money people have in this period. You're going to get an income tax with the Republican-controlled Congress. First time during this war, you'll have an income tax. And, of course, later on, that income tax will be declared unconstitutional, and ultimately we'll get the 16th Amendment. But this is the first time it's tested, the 1860s. So, again, modern America is being formed here in the 1860s. It's the recreation of America. The founders never would have talked about an income tax. And then, of course, you're going to get heavy inflation. Not inflation like we have today, but you're going to see a general uptick in inflation for a time, principally because of the war. But you're going to have a few periods here in the late 19th century before you get the Federal Reserve that you're going to start seeing a general uptick in inflation. So all that's going to be going on here. That's the Republican economic agenda. That's state capitalism being formed in this particular period. Of course, when you start looking at the South and the West, there's also a congressional policy of retribution. You have to punish the South for her sins, and that's the way it was looked at. Punish the South, remake the South. And we're going to talk about what these Southern states become in this presentation, and it's not a very good thing. Of course, the Union Army, when they're done punishing the South, is going to go to the West and punish the Indian tribes there. They're going to make sure that the Indian tribes in the West do exactly what they want. And that's part of Reconstruction, because the same guys that are involved in punishing the South at the end of the war and the military reconstruction of the South are going to be the same guys that are involved in the West and going out and reconstructing the West for Western settlers. You're going to get a changing social order in the United States, and of course the role of minorities is going to drastically change in the U.S. And so oftentimes when you talk about Reconstruction, and this is where the left really controls Reconstruction, because they'll say, oh, yeah, I mean, we get this stuff. But if we didn't have Reconstruction, we wouldn't have these things. And it's not necessarily true. And what you're going to get is tremendous unconstitutional legislation to change the social order. And so do the ends justify the means? I mean, that's always the question here. If we have a written constitution and all the things that are going on here, well, I mean, should we go out and abuse the constitution to have a certain end? I mean, what's the point of constitutional government then? They're not working within the framework of the system. They're not following the system. And I think that's a terrible travesty of Reconstruction, that there is an end around here. You don't follow the Constitution. You just abuse it and do whatever you want. And, of course, Lincoln sets that trend and is followed by the Republicans all the way through and then later on the progressives. So, I mean, this is where the Constitution dies, so to speak. Now, the economic destruction, the social destruction in the South, for example, was tremendous. In terms of per capita, the South was actually the wealthier section when the war began. In fact, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Mississippi were in the top five in 1860 in terms of per capita in the United States. After the war is over, they're in the bottom quadrant of the United States. And by 1880, for example, Louisiana is 37th, went from second to 37th. South Carolina went from third to 45th, Mississippi from fifth to 46th. So they've gone from a very good, thriving situation for the economy in these states, primarily from cotton, to a terrible situation. And so the economic reconstruction, or the economic devastation, I should say, of this war is tremendous. I mean, people that had capital now don't have any. And so it's very hard to have a thriving economy when everybody's broke. And this is one thing that, you know, people don't factor into these protests against rich people. You need rich people. If you don't have rich people, you don't have an economy. The government can't do everything. Rich people have to be there to provide jobs and industry and commerce. I mean, all this stuff has to happen through rich people. And the South is a primary example of that. When Confederate money and bonds are worthless, slave property is lost, and these people have no money to pay wages or anything, well, how do you have a thriving economy? So you're not. You need rich people in your society. The social and physical destruction in the South is tremendous. 258,000 Southerners killed, at least 100,000 wounded, and that's what we know about. For example, all the military records of Alabama were burned, so no one knows for sure how many Alabamians were killed or wounded in the war. It's just a guess. So there's tremendous social destruction. And if you were wounded, it's not like you were wounded today in, with modern medicine. I mean, if you lost an arm or a leg, you're pretty much worthless in terms of being a farmer anymore. So, you know, the physical destruction in the South was terrible. Major cities like Atlanta and Richmond, Charleston, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, Columbus, Georgia, all these places are burned by the Union Army, or in the case of Richmond, the Confederate Army, to keep it out of Union hands. But there's tremendous physical destruction in the South. And that was just your major urban centers. There were other parts of the South that were also destroyed. The Shenandoah Valley, North Alabama. I mean, so terrible, terrible destruction. Vicksburg. Terrible, terrible physical destruction in the South. The amount of property loss was just horrible. Again, Confederate money and bonds were worthless. Land was heavily taxed. So now even if you held on to your property in the South, you're probably going to be taxed to a point where you can't afford it. And of course, that was ultimately the design for some Northerners. Tax the property so much that these people can't afford it anymore, and then you tax them off their land. So this is a terrible situation. Slave property was lost to abolition. And of course, there's no compensation for that. It'd be no different than any property that you have being seized and you're not paid for it, and when you pay a tremendous amount of money for it. So that's going to be a tremendous drain on the economy. Your major trading centers were damaged or destroyed. The infrastructure was severely damaged. There were no rail lines in the South left. All the track was torn up. Locomotives were no working locomotives in the South, so it's very hard to have any type of infrastructure. Your bridges were burned. I mean, all these things are going on in the South. It's a terrible, terrible situation. Most white Southerners were denied the right to vote at one point or another during Reconstruction, so you have a terrible political future for white Southerners. This is a horrible situation. I mean, you can say on one hand, and a lot of people will, that this was justified. The South was justified, or the North was justified in doing this to the South. But I don't know how you can realistically say that. And we're going to talk about what that's going to do to the United States when you start doing this stuff. I mean, if the government can go in and do these things, which they did in the 1860s, I mean, that's a terrifying prospect for all Americans, North and South and West. If the government can take away, the federal government can take away your right to vote, which of course the states always had a primary role in, but that's going to go away. This is a horrible situation for many, many Americans. Now, early Reconstruction, of course, began before the war was over, and I'm going to talk about that with some of the legislation, the National Banking Acts and things like that. When we start looking at the West and homestead legislation, some of that takes place before the war is over. But if you want to look at the actual legislation that's going to go into Reconstruction, you got to go back to about the middle of the war in the Lincoln administration. And of course, Lincoln in his second inaugural said he was going to let the South up easy. With malice towards none, with charity for all, let us strive to bind up the nation's wounds, as he said. But Lincoln, again, if he really wanted to save the Union, he could have. If he was such a benevolent guy, he wouldn't have let Grant go wild in the South, or Sherman go wild in the South. But Lincoln is going to be the center of Reconstruction from the 1860s or the last couple of years of his presidency. In fact, in 1863, he's going to issue something called the Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction. The idea was that if you were in the South and you were waging war against the United States, you could take, unless you were, Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee, you could take an oath of allegiance to the United States and all would be forgiven. And then Lincoln in 1864 had what he called his 10% plan. If 10% of the 1860 voting electorate in any Southern state took this oath of allegiance, they could come back in the Union. They could form a government and be considered part of the Union. So what Lincoln was looking at here, and what historians have often called this, is resumption rather than Reconstruction. They would resume the Union, of course, under the Northern model, but they would resume the Union. So 10%, I mean, that's an achievable goal. When 75% of white Southerners are fighting, that means 25% aren't. So you might be able to get this 10%, and they could have a government. So if the North, in essence, wins the war, there's already a working government in those states. And of course, Lincoln was ingenious in doing this because then he'd have partners in the South to do exactly what he wanted. You'd have already an operating government. You could say that is the legal government of those states. These other governments are in rebellion. So Lincoln was trying to work around some legal issues here that the other Republicans really don't care about. And in fact, really, Lincoln doesn't care about. But he's doing this for political reasons, for rhetorical reasons. He really didn't care about the Constitution. In fact, by 1864, Louisiana, Tennessee, and Arkansas were back in the Union under this 10% plan. Well, that wasn't good enough for the Republicans in Congress. They wanted to punish the South severely. So the radical Republicans, and I'll talk about who these people are in a few minutes, the radical Republicans wanted a much harder approach to Reconstruction. They passed something what's called the Wade-Davis Bill of 1864. This required an ironclad oath that you had never supported the Confederacy in any way, and it required 50% of the voting electorate. Now, if you think about that, 75% of white Southerners are fighting in the war. There's no way they're ever going to get 50% with an ironclad oath. So the idea was never to bring the South back in the Union. They were going to make sure that the South was punished and that they could do exactly what they wanted in these Southern states if the war is over. So what you start having here is a battle between the executive branch and the congressional branch. And what you're ultimately going to get in this particular period is the tyranny of the Republican Party, most importantly, the tyranny of the legislative branch. Now, either way, if you have a strong central figure in the executive, that's dangerous if there's no check from the legislative branch. But it also works in the direct opposite. If the legislative branch can do whatever they want and there's no check from the executive, that can also be a very dangerous thing as well. And we're going to see that during Reconstruction. But most importantly, the final check should have always been the states, and they're gone. That really was the key into this entire union that we had. The states being able to check that central authority and the states being able to have direct control over their domestic concerns. We're not going to have that anymore after this Reconstruction period. Now, of course, Reconstruction will change in April of 1865 when Lincoln is assassinated. And, of course, his vice president, Andrew Johnson, will then assume the presidency. Now, Johnson was from Tennessee. He's a Southern Democrat, but he's what you would call a war Democrat. He supports the war. He's from Eastern Tennessee. And there were a lot of people in Eastern Tennessee who weren't in favor of the Confederacy. So they're going to stay with the Union. So Johnson now will become the 17th president of the United States. And when this happens, generally people think this is going to be a good thing for Reconstruction. In fact, radical Republicans think, well, Johnson hates the South. He hates these slaveholders. Maybe we can actually have a go at this here. Lincoln was viewed as a guy who was going to be much more soft towards the South. Johnson might have been a little harder, but Johnson is a Southerner, and he's not going to abuse all of Southerners, which is what Republicans really wanted to do here. So Johnson is going to generally follow suit with what Lincoln wanted with some modifications. In December of 1865, for example, he declares that the Union has been restored. All the former Confederate states except Texas were back in the Union. He's basically following the plan of Lincoln towards Reconstruction, again, with some slight modifications. But this is when the battle with Congress begins. Johnson was too soft, they thought, just like Lincoln was going to be too soft. And generally, the interpretation here is that if Lincoln had not been killed, Reconstruction would have taken this soft stance on through the line. But I don't know if you can generally say that, because the only reasoning behind that is that Lincoln may have been a little more skilled with his party than, and, you know, Johnson was not a Republican. Lincoln was. But I'm not necessarily sure about that. Lincoln was going to have the same kind of problems Johnson was going to have if you're going to follow this soft stance towards Reconstruction. Johnson, again, had this soft stance on Reconstruction, and his plan was rejected by Congress. In fact, they came up with something called the Joint Committee on Reconstruction in 1865 and 1866. And what they're going to do is say, the Congress, what they're going to do, the Republicans, are going to say that they alone have the power to legislate for Reconstruction. In fact, at this point, when Johnson says that the Union is restored, several high-ranking Confederate officials show up in D.C. to try to take seats in Congress, including, for example, the Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander A. Stephens. He shows up, and they want to get into Congress. Well, they will refuse their seats. So the Republicans say, you can be here, but you're not going to take your seats. And this is really when this radical agenda begins. So we have to talk about here for a second, who were these radical Republicans? And I think when you start looking at this, when you look at this radical agenda and you look at who these people were, it becomes very clear what they were trying to do. For example, you have Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, a guy who said that the Southern states were conquered provinces. So think about that. Now the states, which Lincoln was saying the states were in rebellion, now Thaddeus Stevens is saying these are conquered provinces. Well, that creates a very interesting constitutional question that we'll talk about. So they go from states to conquered provinces. Well, how can that happen? How can the federal government say a state is no longer a state? if the states were primary in creating this union to begin with. But this particular legal issue is never addressed. So what you have here is now the central authority saying they dictate what a state is, who's in the union, et cetera, et cetera. You have Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. We've already talked about him. He said that secession meant reverting to territorial status. So now you're not a state, you're a territory. And of course, the central government can control territories. So again, how can a state revert back? How can it lose its statehood? If these states are simply in rebellion, they never stop being a state. And if they seceded from the Union, they're still a state. This question of what the status of these states are is a principal issue here, because if the states are states, then the radicals can't do what they're doing. If they're provinces, they can, but theoretically. But then, of course, if they're not states, then they can't ratify amendments. And we're going to get into all this legal issues here in a bit. But this is what the radicals are saying. And then you had someone like Benjamin Wade, who, of course, was one of the authors of the Wade-Davis bill. This guy wanted to confiscate all Southern property, arm slaves, and execute Confederate leaders. And what he wanted to do with this confiscated property was theoretically give it to the former slaves, but most importantly, he wanted to give it to his cronies so that they could dominate these Southern states, the carpetbaggers and scalawags. And we'll talk about who those people were. But this is the type of stuff that Southerners are facing in this period, and it's not going to be a very pleasant situation. So, the Republicans are going to start looking at the Southern states in this period. And of course, in 1866, you haven't really had a situation, because Johnson's in control of the executive branch, where the Republicans have free reign in the South. So the South starts going in and reorganizing itself during this process. And what you're going to get in terms of legislation towards black Southerners is something called black codes. Now, black codes are not to be confused with the Jim Crow laws of the late 19th century. This is not legal segregation. In fact, cities were segregated by class more than race in this period. The black codes were similar to laws against free blacks in places like Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio. They're really no different, and Southerners started pointing to that. Well, why are you so critical of our laws when you're doing the exact same thing in your states? Well, that's just not fair, and it wasn't fair. But again, what the Republicans were doing here, when we start talking about black Americans, what they're doing is looking at these people as pawns in a game of chess. These people are votes. They need these votes to make sure the Republicans win elections in the South, because if Republicans win elections in the South, then Republicans can remake the South in their image. If the Republicans don't win elections, then they're in real trouble. So, these black codes were aimed at preventing things like vagrancy. They prohibited interracial marriage. They established what people would say is a master-servant relationship by law. So, they're not good laws. But again, it's not legal segregation. Things in the South were not segregated yet. But these things allow Northern leaders to chastise the South, to say that the South is just out there acting like the South, even though the North was doing the exact same things. So, you have a double standard here for Northerners. Now, the Republicans will pass a number of pieces of legislation designed to, quote-unquote, help black Southerners. For example, the Freedmen's Bureau Bill in 1866. This was designed to enforce the 13th Amendment, and not just, which, of course, ended slavery. And not just that, it was designed to get education to Southern blacks and get these people voting. That was the key. They had to try to eventually to get these people voting. So we are going to get the 15th Amendment, which does that. But they wanted these people out voting as much as they could, because, of course, that means they're going to win elections. They want to give the vote to former slaves and take it away from white Southerners so that they can win. Republicans can win elections. There's a great old book entitled A Documentary History of Reconstruction. It's very hard to find, but if you can find it, what this book did was go back and look at some primary documents and what the impact of the Freedmen's Bureau Bill had on the South. And oftentimes this is seen as a very generous, righteous thing the North is doing here. But if you look at the people that were going into the South, it wasn't always seen that way. You had one particular case, for example, when you had a lot of these teachers that came in were from Northern areas. And this one lady thought that black Southerners smelled real bad and that they needed a bath. So she starts taking them out in the river and bathing them, and she ends up drowning a few of them. And, it wasn't that these people, that's a horrible story, but this is the kind of stuff that was happening. It wasn't that these people were just good, noble people all the time. Sometimes they were doing some very cruel things to black Southerners. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 granted freedmen citizenship and allowed them to own property and sue in court. So here you have your first civil rights legislation, quote-unquote civil rights legislation in American history. Again, The idea was to try to get black Southerners participating in the South to make sure that the Northern ideology is going to dominate and they're going to win elections. Because, of course, the Republican Party is the party of Lincoln, the party that freed the slaves. That's exactly who these former slaves are going to vote for. Now, Johnson will veto both pieces of legislation. He'll say they're unconstitutional. It's a violation of states' rights. And he was right. I mean, education was never the purview of the federal government. Civil rights was never the purview of the federal government. These were state issues. Who can sue and who can become a citizen, essentially, is a state issue. What the central government is saying here is that, no, it's not a state issue anymore. If you are a citizen of the United States, you're now a citizen of the state in which you live. Well, that's not the case. The state society is a citizen of their state. But what you're going to get here is now that the states have no control over that anymore, and you're really going to see that with the 14th Amendment. This is the beginning of that process and getting that 14th Amendment. Congress will just override his veto, and so both pieces of legislation will become law in 1867. So Johnson really is ineffective here. And what the Republicans are going to start doing is waging a very ingenious propaganda war, a political war here, rhetorical war, I should say. In the 1866 congressional elections, they're going to go out and start saying that if you support the Democrats, you support the Confederacy. It's no different than today that if you vote against the Republican Party, well, then theoretically you support Al-Qaeda. And that's not necessarily true at all. But this is when this kind of stuff begins. Well, if you support the Democrats, you support the enemy. If you support the Democrats today, you support the enemy. If you're not for the war, you're for the enemy. Again, not true, but it's going to have an important impact on the election because people buy this stuff. In fact, these are the type of words that they use in this particular period in defining what they're going to do. This was a righteous cause to forge a new union, to avenge the Union men who died in the war, to punish the South, to remake the South. This is one party, one branch control of the government. It's the tyranny of the Republican Party, and there's no other way to look at it. I mean, think about that. And they actually said this. This is a righteous cause to forge a new union. A new union. Okay, so with that in mind, we're going to pick up with this in the second part of this presentation and this North over South. And ultimately, this will bridge into my talk about corruption and compromise and all the things that are going on during the end of Reconstruction, the Grant administration, and so on and so forth. But think about that. A righteous cause to forge a new union. That is so important. A new union. And again, that's what Reconstruction is all about.